Okay, so here we go. We're starting a new series today based on this book called God in My Head by Joshua Stephen Grizzetti. He is nobody in the publishing world. He's a New York actor who says this is his first and probably only book. He self-published it last year because he couldn't stop talking about what happened to him or what he thinks happened to him. I heard about it from my friend Jim Blake, who is the new CEO at Unity World Headquarters. Last summer, he just practically insisted that I read it. So I did, and I thought, I already know this. But I kept thinking about it, and I finally decided we needed to go through it together and discuss it. So, just to give you some logistics, I'll talk about the book for 4 Sundays, and I'll tell you what thoughts it prompted in me. And then you have home study groups for more discussion, if you want, because you might have a completely different reaction to it. I tested the book on about 6 of you. Last year, 6 people read it. Some liked it, some didn't, but they all wanted to talk about it. It is not a Unity book per se. You might agree with parts of it and not others. And I'm not trying to give a book report, but I will give you a spoiler alert, because I'll be telling you what happens. There are readings for each talk and the home groups that'll be in the newsletter every week. So for today, it's chapters 1-7 and the first 2 parts of chapter 8. But I'll also be saying enough that you don't have to read the book in order to get something from the talks. Okay? So that's how it works. Joshua Grizzetti was a kid growing up in Roanoke, Virginia. His parents were staunch Southern Baptists, and so was he. It was the only view of God he knew. In the course of his childhood, pretty early, he developed some cavities and went to the dentist to have them filled. Not every book combines dental work with God, but this one does. It turned out that Novocaine had no effect on Joshua's teeth. It would numb his soft tissue, the cheek and gums, but not his actual teeth, so drilling was excruciating. You can read the grisly details, but basically, no one believed this little boy about how much it hurt, and they held him down and drilled his teeth while he screamed. Now, Joshua seems to have had more cavities than any human being I know. So this horrible experience was repeated over and over. He learned much later there is such a thing as post-traumatic dental care anxiety. And of course, he started to panic whenever he had to go to the dentist. In hindsight, it looks like child abuse to hold him down and hurt him like that. But his parents, and apparently the dentist, didn't know what was really happening. They thought Joshua was just being overly sensitive, because it didn't hurt them when the dentist worked on their teeth. Joshua was just a big crybaby. Which raises a question for us. How often do we refuse to believe others when they tell us about their pain? Maybe it's physical pain. Everyone has a different threshold of what they can tolerate. Some need medication before others do. If you're super sensitive to pain, you may be labeled drug-seeking when you're really just seeking help. But I suspect it happens even more often that we neglect or diminish others' emotional pain. So, for instance, one person gets a divorce and they're ready to move on. Another person gets a divorce and it takes years to work through it. We see this in grief. We grieve differently and tend to judge each other for it. One person is getting on with life while another still cries every day. We know that divorce skyrockets among couples who've lost a child, often because they grieve differently. People have different levels of fear, too. I don't understand people who are afraid of public speaking. But I'm not looking at anyone. But I have some fears that other people might think are irrational. So, if you're the one who's not crying every day, or you're the one who's not afraid, it can be tempting to say, get over it. grow up, put on your big boy pants, whatever you say. And when someone shares their pain, you might try to comfort them by insisting it's really not as bad as they think, because it wouldn't be that bad for you. Now, we all know people who seem to share nothing but their pain. I'm not looking at anyone. But they've become identified with their story. Maybe they were abused as a child, or they've went through a period of addiction, or they're still crying about a death 20 years ago. And we might want to say, could you just turn the page? I suppose sometimes we are enabling someone by continuing to let them run their story. But I think it's more likely that we're not believing someone when they try to tell us about their pain. And I would err on the side of believing them. Even if you've heard the story a dozen times before, obviously it still hurts them. Joshua Grizzetti fought and screamed and cried at every dentist appointment. It never got any better, and he couldn't make anyone understand. So Joshua, still a little boy, decided this was punishment from God. There was no point in asking for help. He knew he was supposed to turn to God for everything, but obviously God didn't care about this. So from about the ages of 8 to 14, he stopped believing in God. This is from chapter 4. He says, I don't know exactly how or when it happened. One day I just turned around and God was gone. My faith was gone. The sensation that some magical being was walking through life with me, sympathizing with my existential wailings and thanksgivings, guiding me towards some destiny that was designed especially for me, it was all gone. In its place, there was a cold reality, I thought, that I was alone in a chaotic universe, spinning hopelessly into oblivion. This is a kid. Joshua came back to the Christian fold as a teenager when someone reminded him he could go to hell. But even that didn't last. As he grew up and went out into the world, he realized that all kinds of good people did not fit the Southern Baptist cookie cutter of virtue. And he couldn't believe they were all going to hell. He even really liked some gay people. And he began to be embarrassed by the judgments of the church he grew up in. He was also disturbed by the randomness of life. He thought believing in God should have some benefits, but bad things happened to good people all the time. The world was full of suffering, and he developed massive resentment toward God, and this time angrily stopped believing. He says, I wanted him to know how disappointed I was in him, how undeserving he was of my devotion. In a way, it was very freeing. It was like breaking up with an abusive partner. Imagine a spouse that only offered to love you conditionally, who threatened you constantly with torturous damnations, who berated you and told you how awful and undeserving you were, who never picked up the phone, but still insisted he was getting your voicemails even though he never bothered responding to them. It felt like that was the relationship I was ending. It felt fantastic. It felt terrifying, because I knew there'd never be another relationship like it. My days with religion had ended. This was the bitter, desolate spiritual place I found myself in when I met him, God, the almighty creator of the universe. Funnily enough, my dentist introduced us. So Joshua broke up with his Southern Baptist God without knowing there were any alternatives. I did exactly that. Some of you did too. We left rigid churches thinking they were the only way to view God or ourselves. And if we didn't believe that way, then we didn't belong anywhere. So remember, as you read this book, Joshua is coming straight out of the Baptist church into what he calls meeting God. You already know there are other ways to see the universe. So some of the things that surprised him might not surprise you. You'll also notice that he conflates all of Christianity with his Southern Baptist upbringing. At the end of the book, he does acknowledge his experience with God reflected his existing beliefs, or the beliefs he was rejecting, his Baptist frame of reference. But it also included some entirely new material, and I'm guessing some of it will be new to you too. I can't vouch for it. It's Joshua's experience. He ends up saying everyone has to have their own experience, but I think it's fascinating. So Joshua continued to have cavities as an adult, and he began to medicate himself before the dentist visit. They gave him anti-anxiety medication because they still thought he was just afraid, not really in pain. And he would double up on the anti-anxiety meds and mix that with alcohol and sometimes marijuana. And he had some pretty loopy experiences. He does not recommend that you try this at home. But one day, he stumbled upon just the right combination of drugs and alcohol before the dentist, and then nitrous oxide at the dentist's office. He ended up in total blackness, beyond time and space. He thought he had died. There was nothing but silence and stillness. And then he began to see beacons of light. He realized each one represented a major event of his life. He could hold them. So there was a beacon of light for his wedding day. There was a beacon for a job he'd recently lost. There was a beacon for his dental experiences and all the spiritual lessons that would come from that. He could see that the beacons of light extended far back before his birth into this lifetime and extended far past the day of what would be his death in this lifetime. And he saw how insignificant his fear of dentists was in this great eternal sweep of his existence. So remember that perspective next time you have a problem. And I don't have time to tell you about his great descriptions of what he went through. He's really a good writer, and I hope you'll read it. But he finally dropped into an abyss that he knew was his subconscious. And he experienced what he called ear-splitting silence. He says, this was it, the bottom. I was deep inside myself, utterly alone. It was a menacing, soul-consuming solitude. I looked up from where I had fallen, and there was nothing. I looked behind me into the darkness, and there was nothing, not even the slightest hint of shape or substance. I turned forward again, then staggered back as I saw him, standing not 2 feet in front of my face, his eyes piercing through me, his visage stern, and his entire body coursing with a palpable energy that illuminated him through the stifling darkness. He was epic and devastating. His presence pulled all of the air from my lungs so that I gasped and fell to my knees. I was standing face to face with God. Again, Joshua thought he died, and this was Judgment Day, that he would be facing the wrath of God. And sure enough, God did speak to him in a booming voice. He said, "Stop telling people I don't exist." God pointed out that not believing in God had not made Joshua any happier. So Joshua gathered up his courage and said, "Yeah, well, but what's wrong with needing proof?" Doubting Thomas was allowed his doubts, and he got verification. And God had a surprising response. He said two things. One, doubting Thomas is part of the Jesus story, and nearly everything we think we know about Jesus is wrong or distorted. And we'll get to that later. God also said, doubt is necessary for faith. God said that, not Joshua. He let Joshua know that different people need different amounts of proof or logic before they can take the leap of faith into believing something they can't prove. Some refuse to make that leap at all, and that's okay. None of it is judged, but doubt is part of it. And I suppose doubt as part of faith makes sense, Faith, by definition, well, in the Bible, it says faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. So faith cannot rest entirely on logic or proof. It's believing what we can't see. But God did offer some proof to Joshua, two ways. First, he promised to answer any questions that Joshua had about the universe, and he said he would make a physical demonstration. Well, by now, Joshua's skepticism was back. So he said, yeah, well, it's going to have to be something pretty big. You're going to have to move a mountain or something to convince me this is real. And what happened next is my least favorite part of this book. I'm still trying to understand it. But this was the physical demonstration of God's power. According to Joshua, God made him aware again that he was in the dentist chair. God seemed to take over his thoughts and freeze his body with his eyes open. God told him the dentist was about to hit a nerve with his drill. And of course, that was Joshua's greatest fear. But this time, it was ramped up 1,000 times. He calls it supernatural terror. And he finally understood the term fear of God. So Joshua started crying out, I believe in you. Don't show me anymore. I believe. And suddenly Joshua was back in the black abyss with God. Everything was fine. He was not hurt. God said he would never have hurt Joshua, that in fact, Joshua's fear of pain is what had summoned God. God wasn't going to torture him with it. Okay, so what was that about? God said, I told you that in order to understand me, you must first understand my true power. In your earthly body, this can only come through the knowledge of fear. He told me that fear is the first gate through which all men must pass in order to truly know God. Many try to reach him without fear and they fail. Through this terrifying example, I had just passed through the gate. Now my understanding of God could begin. Okay, he's using some Baptist terminology there, and I get that his understanding was that God is vastly more powerful than we realize. We look for God to move mountains when there is divine power in the blink of an eyelid, the beating of our heart, in our ability to think. It's all God. But is it true we have to fear God to know God? And does this mean fear as in terror? Or is it more like awe? I'm still ruminating on this chapter. It's chapter 7. Because I don't want it to be true. And I'll be interested to hear what you come up with in your study groups. But this is Joshua's version of what happened. And now he is convinced that God has proven himself. So God keeps his second promise to answer any questions. Chapter 8 is divided into parts, many parts, based on those questions. God talked to him and showed him things. Joshua knows he does not remember 70 to 80% of it and won't until after his death. But these are the answers he remembers. His first question was what God looks like. Now, Joshua had been with him all this time, but he finally looked and realized that God looked like Joshua because Joshua only trusted himself. I think that's sad. But that was his image, and we all impose some image on God. And what is God? Everything anyone has ever thought God might be is true. God is a paradox, not singular or plural, male or female, not black or white, yes or no, but both, all of it. God is nature, science, philosophy. Atheists are a part of God. God is also the narrow God of rigid religions, as well as all the other concepts. He speaks different spiritual languages, so all can understand. Here's how God described himself. I am the sunrise and I am the night. I am the God of your forefathers and the knowledge of your grandchildren. I am wisdom itself. I am energy. I am light. I am love. I am war and I am peace. I am the water and the fire. I am life and I am death. I am time itself. I'm the beginning and the end. I'm all there ever was and all there ever will be. There is no name large enough to contain me. I simply am. I am nameless, yet have more names than can be counted. To understand this is to understand the nature of God. Joshua talks about God revealing himself. And this experience, his vision or hallucination, cast God as a supreme being who was willing to get acquainted more closely. I don't think God reveals itself. If God just is, then what we call revelation is just our own increased awareness of what was already there. It's human imagination coming up with images for what it feels and senses in that presence. If God is all there is, then any name or face or activity we attribute to God is true, but it's only a tiny slice of the infinite that our brains can hold on to. Still, in Joshua's vision, God was nice enough to answer a whole slew of Joshua's questions, and they're the same ones I think many of us would ask. So we'll continue with the answers next week, starting with, where did God come from? But let's take these thoughts into meditation. To meditate, we become still and relaxed. You might want to take a deep breath, close your eyes, and turn within. What we know is that we don't have to go anywhere to meet God. The energy we call God is right here. In us, around us, among us, in each other. So turn within to that place where you may know the presence. In whatever form or image you give it, or none at all, maybe it's just a feeling. We may have so many questions. But the one answer to everything is love. That we are loved, that we are made of love, that everything going on in our lives is based in love. That this human experience is only a part of our soul's eternal journey. So we can broaden our perspective. Look at the bigger picture. Know that ultimately all is well and all is love. We encounter God in our own ways and give it many different names. Angels, guides, Jesus, sometimes other people. So take just a moment deep within yourself to meet your God. We're so grateful to know that this presence is always available to us. We're never separate from it because we are part of the infinite. We can't not be with God. And so we learn to rely on that, to ask for help, to co-create, to be the best human being we can be in this experience, knowing that our spiritual journey of learning will continue after this. We meet our God every day, all the time. And so it is. Amen.